All right, good morning. Welcome to Xenos Christian Fellowship Eastside. Glad everybody's here. We're going to continue our series in the Gospel of John. I encourage you to turn to chapter 2. That's where we'll be today. So while you're doing that, I'm going to pray really quick. Father, I thank you for this opportunity to get together and study your word. And I pray that you teach us through it. I pray that you teach us what you want us to learn and help us to ignore all the smells coming over there from the potluck. And the weight will make things much better, God. I just pray that we can not rush through things just for that. Amen. All right. Well, we are going to be studying a passage that there's a little bit of debate on, actually, in John. Last week we had a snowstorm. 2 weeks ago, we studied a wedding where Jesus was invited to the wedding, him and his disciples and his mother, and there was a party there. They ran out of wine, and Jesus miraculously made more wine, like gallons of more wine, hundreds of gallons of more wine, so the party could continue. And after that, it says that after this, he went down to Capernaum, and he and his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. Now, we're going to study this passage now where Jesus cleanses the temple, which you're probably familiar with it, but if you're not, it's okay, because we're going to look at it. But there's a little bit of debate as to whether or not this happened more than once. Because the other Gospels record the cleansing of the temple near the end of the Gospels, and this one records it at the beginning. So either it happened twice, at the beginning of his ministry or at the end of it, or he did it once, and then that John, though, decided that he's going to put it at the beginning of his Gospel for a reason. And there's debate going either way. I'm inclined to think that it would only happen once. That's the kind of thing that would get you a lifetime ban, I would think, but who knows. I guess the reason I think that, and I know commentators go both ways on it, they're split 50-50, I think, down the middle on it, whether or not there was more than one. The point here is that John says the point of his Gospel, unlike the Gospel of Luke, where Luke says at the beginning, the point of this Gospel is to lay out everything that Jesus began to do and to teach, right? And he in chronological order. That was the Gospel of Luke's purpose. The Gospel of John's purpose is slightly different. John says, talking about the signs that Jesus did, he says, therefore many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you may believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing that, you may have life in his name. So John's purpose is not to be a biography of Jesus. His purpose is to make, I mean, that's been done. John knew that the other Gospels were written. This was written after them. He knew what they said. This is his perspective, and this is written so that we would believe who he was and who he said he was. And so he put this, whether it happened twice or it happened just once, either way, he put this story after the story at Cana on purpose. He put this story after Jesus was at this wedding. Now we've got this story of Jesus cleansing the temple. And there's a reason for that. I think we need to draw a direct comparison, because his purpose, remember, is for us to learn who Jesus is. And last thing we studied was Jesus doing something that may have been unexpected, especially by some of the fundamentalist perspective today, where you go to a wedding and there's a lot of drinking, and these weddings would last for days, which is why they were probably running out of wine. They would last for days. They would include most of the town. And there was some drinking going on, and they ran out of wine. And some people today would say, well, now Jesus is probably getting angry about all that drinking, and he's wanting to put a stop to it. Instead, he doesn't get angry with it. In fact, he does something miraculous so that it can continue. Now we're going to see what really does get Jesus angry. So we're going to see two sides of Jesus, a side of him that is celebrating and a side of him that is angry. And so we want to compare and contrast those two things. So let's take a look at our passage. It starts in verse 13 of chapter 2. It says, the Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers seated at their tables, and he made a scourge of cords and drove them out of the temple, with the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers, and he overturned their tables. And to those who were selling the doves, he says, take these things away. Stop making my father's house a place of business. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. And so before we get into why Jesus did what he did, we will get into that. I want to talk about just what he did and then what the reaction was to him, because I think that's important. So first of all, we want to be clear about what Jesus did. It says here that he made a scourge of cords. Now, if you're like me and you think of a scourge as like a whip, and Jesus looks like this. You know, he's like Indiana Jones with the bullwhip, and he's taking out people's eye sockets and stuff, and just taking names. I don't think that's really what was going on. First of all, he don't think he wore a lot of leather. What he did was this cords, the word that's translated cords, it's translated from the word rushes. If you've ever heard of rushes, this is what they used a lot of the times to put floors. Rushes were like a large grass-like plant. I don't know how well you can see that picture, but they're large and they're like grass. And when you dry them out, you can make cords out of them, and then they weave those cords into all kinds of things like carpets and rugs, and they'll even put them on chairs and stuff. So while it would sting like the dickens, it's probably not likely he was taking out people's eyeballs with it. Instead, he was likely using it just to drive the animals out of the temple, and maybe the people too. Clearly, he was angry. He was flipping over tables and talking to them about what they were doing wrong. But it doesn't look like he was out there, you know, breaking bones and stuff. I mean, he was just driving people out for a reason. So that's what happened. And as I said, we're going to look at why he did that. But you see as much as they saw right here. This is what Jesus did. He came in by himself to the temple, which was crowded because it was Passover. People came from all over Israel, they came from all over the Roman Empire because the Jews had been kind of dispersed, and they were coming here to do the sacrifices that were required for Passover. So it was very crowded with people, with animals, and with priests and scribes. And he comes in there by himself with nothing but a cord whip and drove everybody out of the temple. As you can imagine, there might be some questions asked. So let's see what they asked. The Jews then said to him, "What sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "It took 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So, when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. Okay, so the first question they ask is not, why are you doing this? They didn't even ask, who do you think you are? I mean, imagine somebody coming in here flipping over tables and kicking out our donuts and, you know, knocking over the coffee stand over there and preaching to us. We would probably have a few questions, right? And yet, they didn't only, not only did they not ask him those questions, but they listened to him, they obeyed him. He drove them out by himself. He didn't have an army with him. And so they ask him, what sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things? They're not saying, do you have the authority? Because they obviously recognize that he did. They're standing outside the temple. They were inside, now they're outside. They're asking him, what signs do you show to show you have this authority? Where did you get this authority from? Because they already obeyed him. They recognized he had some authority. And I don't know if it was just his presence, his anger, if there was something more supernatural involved. It's not clear. But it's clear that they recognized he had some authority because they all obeyed him. And they all ran out. And so Jesus tells them this, which seems kind of cryptic. He says, well, you want a sign? Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So they argue, well, look, you said that this temple took us 46 years to build. In fact, that's not even really true. It was 46 years since they had started it, but it wasn't even really finished yet. It wasn't finished for a few more years after this event. So they had questions, right, about are you really going to raise this temple up in 3 days if it gets destroyed? And remember when Jesus is before Pontius Pilate, and he's before the priest, high priest and stuff. They threatened him with this. They actually said, well, he threatened to destroy the temple and raise it up in 3 days, which is not at all what he did. You can see he just said, if you destroy the temple, I will raise it up in 3 days. And he's not even referring to the temple. So what is this 3 day thing that he's talking about? In Matthew 12, the Pharisees are asking him a similar question. They're asking him for a sign. And they said, teacher, we want a sign from you. And he answered and he said to them, an evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, yet no sign will be given it, but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. So Jesus here he's tying himself to Jonah. This 3 days and three nights thing was something he said more than once. And he's referring to Jonah here. And I wanted to point this out, one, because it's very, I find it fascinating. Two, because I just read a book about Jonah, and so it's on my mind. So now it's going to be on yours. Jonah, I don't know how familiar you are. Most people are familiar with most of the story of Jonah, where God says to Jonah, Jonah's a prophet. God says to him, hey, I want you to go to Nineveh and give him a warning. Because Nineveh was the capital city of Israel's greatest enemy at the time, which is Assyria. They were unusually brutal and violent for that time in that area, and they were very ruthless. And Israel, in fact, years later, they did conquer Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel. So Jonah was a guy who really liked his country. He had a lot of patriotism. So he did what God asked him to do. He packed up, got on a boat, and went the opposite direction from Nineveh. He ran away. He said, I'm not giving them any warnings. I want them to be destroyed. If you're going to destroy him, just do it. I'm not going to give him a warning. So he runs. And, of course, the sea picks up, and there's a storm, and they throw him in the ocean, and the fish swallows him up, and he's in this fish for 3 days. Most people are familiar with that story, right? So he's in the belly of the fish, and he starts to really realize what's going on with himself. He's coming to grips with, look, God, salvation is only through God, he says in Jonah 2. And so God has the whale spit him out, and he goes to Nineveh, gives the shortest sermon ever, you will be destroyed in a few days. That's pretty much all he says. Now, the people of Nineveh listen to him, oddly enough. I mean, this is a big town. They said it took 3 days to walk from one end of the town to the other. I mean, it's not a town, it's a city. 120,000 people live in there. And they repented. They listened, and they repented. Now, it doesn't say they all converted to Judaism, because they probably didn't, but they repented from their violent ways, which is what God was mad about. But Jonah did this crazy thing, and this is the part that most people forget about. Jonah went out of the town, and he sat down, and he was mad at God because he was sparing them. He's watching the town. He says, I want you to destroy this place, and you're not going to do it. I knew it when you asked me to go here that you'd be merciful to these people, and I knew that you weren't going to destroy them, and that's why I ran in the first place. What's going on here? Why would Jesus tie himself to a prophet like this? Well, let's think about Jonah. He was a guy. He was all about Israel. He loved his people, and he didn't want to help out the enemy. He didn't want to reach out to those who were different from him, people who were on the other side. And so he didn't. And when he finally did, he did it half-heartedly, and they still responded. But he was angry that God was showing them mercy. He wanted God to destroy them. And now we have Jesus, who is coming. As opposed to, Jonah was kind of forced to do this, Jesus came voluntarily to people who were hostile towards God, who were very different from him, who didn't want to listen to him. And he came to them anyway, and he showed them love. And he's saying to these people now, remember Jonah and that story that we all are familiar with. I'm here like him, and you people are Nineveh. You people are the ones who are hostile towards God. And I'll prove it to you when you put me to death. Because remember, he says he was talking about the temple of his body. The temple was a place where people would go and they would get close to God. It was where they would go to do their sacrifices. They would go there as they were right now for Passover, so they could do their sacrifices that would pay for their sins, and they would get close to God. They could have a relationship with God. That's what the temple was for. Jesus is now saying, I'm the temple. This is my house. I'm the temple now. You don't need this temple. These sacrifices are about to come become irrelevant. I'm the temple. And when you destroy me, the proof that this is true is that when I get killed, I will come back in 3 days. That's what he's saying to them. That's a really crazy thought to say that I'm the temple now. I'm the way you get to God is what he's saying. So now we've learned some new things about Jesus. Now remember, when we first started this series, we were talking about if you wanted to know God, God's really big. He's infinite. He's hard to get our hands around. But if you want to get to know him, get to know Jesus. Because Jesus is the filter that God provided for us so we can get to know him, so we can see what God is like in human form. We already saw one thing about God, that he doesn't mind a party, that he likes getting together with people. He likes social activities, and he likes celebration. Now we learned something else about God. So let's compare these two things. Let's compare the wedding versus the cleansing of the temple. First of all, the wedding. At the wedding, Jesus was an invited guest. They invited him to come there. But at the temple, he's the unwanted owner. He's the owner of the house, and nobody wants him there. It's a very different situation. At the wedding, he continues the party. He allows the party to continue by creating hundreds of gallons of wine, and it was good stuff too. They even commented on how good it was. So the party and the celebration for these people's marriage could continue. At the temple, he puts an end to things. He puts an end to the transgressions. Instead, he's a party pooper, right? He's the ultimate party pooper. He didn't just say, all right, the party's over. He drove people out. So he's putting an end to things here. So at the wedding, did you notice when we studied this, no one questioned his authority? Remember the story? Somebody comes up to Jesus, his mother comes up to Jesus and says, hey, they ran out of wine. And he says, what's that have to do with me? Which seems kind of rude, but we talked about that. And she says to the people, she says to the waiters and the staff, just do whatever he says. And they said, what? Who's this guy? No, they did whatever he says. Nobody questioned his authority. But here he comes to the temple, his own place, and they question him. His authority is questioned by those who were there. And let's think about, why do you think that these two groups of people approached him differently? Well, at the party, he was the Lord of the feast, right? He enabled the feast to continue. He gave them something to celebrate. He gave them joy. But at the temple, he was the judge. It seems like we're very often happy to have Jesus in our lives when things are going well, when he brings us the joy, when he's the Lord of the feast. We're happy to enjoy his authority. Right? We're happy to call on his authority when we're calling out other people in their sin. We're happy to have his authority right up until he's judging us. Then all of a sudden, who do you think you are? Who are you? All of a sudden, where do you get your authority? All of a sudden, I don't even think you exist. I don't think you're good. Are you like me, where you complain to God when things go bad? When things are going south in your life, do you complain to God about that? It's amazing how people do that. I know people who don't believe in God specifically because things go bad in their lives, right? How could he allow this to happen to me or other people? They usually say other people, all the evil in the world. What they really mean is me. How could he, make bad things happen to me? And the funny thing is, you can't say to God, and you have the authority to do something and you didn't do it, right? Well, by complaining to God, we're saying he is powerful and he's amazing and he could have fixed this and he didn't do it. But you can't say that while at the same time complaining that you know what he should do better than he does, right? We can't question, if he's that big that he could have done something, then he's so big that we can't question his methods. We can't fathom his methods. He's going to do what he's going to do. And so here we have the wedding and the temple. We have Jesus as both the Lord of the feast, when things go well, who brings joy, and he's the judge as well, who brings the whip to correct us when we're doing things that are against his will. And he has the authority to be both things. Now we're starting to learn something about who God really is. He's not just some elderly grandfather in the sky who nods down at his people, oh, those kids, they're just going to do what they're going to do. That's not who he is. He loves when we celebrate. He loves to bring us happiness. But he also has to judge when we're wrong. And he has to bring us correction when we're wrong. And so now we're learning a lot about who this guy Jesus and also who God really is. So why did he cleanse the temple? If we say that he has the authority to judge, which he does, what is he judging here specifically? Let's take a look. We can learn a lot. First of all, he gets to the temple and he sees what's going on, not across the street. He doesn't see what's going on down the road or even out front. This is the stuff that's going on in the temple. In the temple, this is the stuff, whatever's going on that he doesn't like is going on right inside the temple. And so what does he do? He goes in there and he flips out the tables. He's driving people out. He's turning over money changers, baskets and stuff. Why is he doing that? Well, when you think about what's going on, the temple wasn't that huge. I mean, it was big by their standards, but it wasn't. Days like Passover, it was very, very busy. And you had people coming from all over, and they were supposed to bring sacrifices with them. They were supposed to bring their own sacrifices, and it's hard to do that if you're coming from the other side of the Roman Empire, or even the other side of Israel. It's hard to bring your own sacrifice, particularly if you're bringing doves, for example, because they're hard to keep alive in those little cages and stuff. So people would bring money to buy the stuff. Well, lo and behold, we know that there's an issue here, so we're going to be able to sell you the animals for your sacrifices. Oftentimes people would come in. Now, this is not written in the Bible, but I've read some other accounts where people would come in and they would bring in their sacrifice and they would say, that one's got some faults. You know, they're supposed to be without blemish, but we've got a nice new one over here. We'll sell you. But the truth of the matter is he specifically turns over the money changers' tables because people would come in. Well, you know, you can't pay here with pesos. You got to pay with dollars. So what's the exchange rate? And it was always very, very in their favor, right? Your drachmas aren't right. You got to get our drachmas or whatever. So the money changers were kind of shortchanging folks. And we know that he was specifically angry about how they were treating the poor because he specifically said to the people who were selling doves to take their stuff away, not to make his father's house a place of business. And the people who were selling doves, why would he specify them specifically? Well, people who couldn't afford the ox or people who couldn't afford the sheep for the sacrifice, the really poor people, they're the ones who had to have the dove. And if they couldn't bring the dove, they had to pay for the dove, and they were shortchanging the poor. Okay, so that makes him angry. There's a lot more going on here, though, than just that they're making money off the poor. In Matthew's account of this, of the cleansing of the temple, he said to them, "It is written, my father's house shall be called a house of prayer, but you're making it a robber's den." See, this word for temple, it literally means sanctuary there. It's supposed to be a house of prayer. It's supposed to be where people would come, especially at Passover, where they would come and they would look at the sacrifices that had to be made because of their sin. They recognized that I'm in sin. That's what the whole sacrificial system was about. I'm in sin. I'm a sinner. I deserve God's judgment. But he's allowing me to bring this sacrifice once a year to pay for my sin, and so that I can be free from that, and so I don't have to be judged and be killed for my rebellion against him. And it was supposed to make them think and contemplate and pray to God, thank you for providing this. Thank you for providing an ultimate sacrifice that's supposed to be coming later, because all the animal sacrifices were just pointing forward to a sacrifice that Jesus himself was going to make. And so it was supposed to be a time of contemplation. And instead what they were doing is they were making it a business transaction. You come in, get your sacrifice, you come over here, they slice his throat, you're good for the year, goodbye. And now you can go on and you can live your life, God's happy with me, I can do whatever I want because next year I'll bring another sheep or a goat or I'll buy a dove or whatever. And it's okay, and it's all transactional. It's not a house of prayer anymore. You see what he's saying? He's saying it's not that they're making money, it's that they're turning their relationship with God into something that's just a transaction where I get to do what I want, and as long as I jump through this hoop, then I'm okay. And that's not at all what it was supposed to be doing. And so the warning here is, don't be turning your faith into a transaction. What are the signs? How do we know if this is happening in our own lives? Because it does. It happens to me all the time. For example, we become a little bit blasé about sin. Oh, whoops, I shouldn't have judged that guy. God's going to be mad. I thank God I'm forgiven. And we go on. Without ever thinking about how God is really offended by that sin so much that Christ had to die for it. Just that one. If it was the only one I had, that's the one that Christ would have died for. Thank God he did. So we get a little bit blasé about our sin. We don't really work on the areas of sin in our lives. We don't really even consider the areas of the sins in our lives. We have a transaction. The transaction's taking place, and it was a good one in our favor. Christ died for our sins, so now I can do whatever I want. We wouldn't say that, but we act that way. What about this? We complain when we fail. We complain when we fail. When we launch into a ministry, or we make a mistake in our marriage, and our kids are angry at us, or whatever. Something happens, and we fail, and we're mad at God. And we complain to him. Well, I thought you were with me. I thought you wanted me to do this. Well, he's the one who's in charge. Who are we to decide what's failure and what's not? Maybe there's a reason that those things happened in the way they did for his purposes. We feel distant from God, even though we may be involved in his word and or his church. It is very possible. You might say, well, I'm coming to church because I want to get close to God. You know, a lot of people this time of year, it's a new year, New Year's resolution. I want to get close to God, so I'm going to start going to church. Good, that's not bad. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. What I'm saying is you can be involved in church heavily. You can be studying his word religiously and still feel distant from God. And it might just be because you've turned this into a transaction. I'm trying to get something from him. I'm trying to get some joy from him. I'm trying to get some satisfaction. I'm trying to get some sense of accomplishment from him. Something from him that I'm trying to get, so I'm doing the things that he wants me to do so I can get from him the things that I want from him. What are you doing? It's a transaction. Jesus had a problem with that. He said in Matthew, he called them hypocrites. He said, rightly does Isaiah prophesy you that this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me. If you only love God because of what God gives you, you don't love God, you love his things. You're not in it to have a relationship with him, you're in it to get his stuff, to get his blessings. That's a transaction, and that's not what God's about. He's not a vending machine. So we can get distant, feel distant from God because he's trying to get us to realize that's not how you get close to me. You don't get close to me by jumping through hoops. You get close to me because you get into your word and you get involved in church because you love me. Not because you want to get stuff. That stuff, you will get blessings absolutely from him, but only as much as you seek him alone and not his thing. We turn our noses up at opportunities to serve. Oh, I'm guilty of this one big time. We have an opportunity to help somebody in need. What do? Yeah, busy today. That's what Jesus said, right? As Jesus said, I'm busy today. Let him go. Never, never did Jesus say, I'm too busy for you. We live our lives unaffected by God's truth. We live our lives, we say we believe in Christ, we say we believe we're saved through him, and we live our lives every other day of the week, besides the days we go to church, as if we're just like everybody else in society. We're nominal Christians, but in action, we're actually atheists because we're not affected by his truth. It doesn't reach into our heart and change the way we live. It doesn't change the way we think. We ignore God or get angry with him when he's trying to make changes in our lives. When God starts flipping tables in your life, we get angry. When he flips tables in mine, I know I do. How dare you turn this on my head? I was serving you. I was helping you. I was doing what I thought you wanted me to do. And now all of a sudden, you're flipping the tables in my life. All upside down. You're driving everything away. We get mad at him. Is it possible that the God of the universe, who is incomprehensible to us, has a plan that's just beyond our capability to see? Is it possible that he knows what he's doing when he's doing it? Or is it only possible that if he's not doing it my way, he doesn't know what he's doing? That's what happens when we have a transactional relationship with God. We say to him, I did all the things you wanted me to do, and yet you didn't give me what I wanted. You welched on your end of the deal. God says, this is not a transaction. This is a relationship. And if you've ever been in a relationship, ever, with anyone, they're going to make you mad. You're going to disagree. And God can't, and in God's case, he's always right. He knows what he's doing. It's okay to be angry at God. It happens. I get angry at God. But we have to be able to recognize that, yep, I'm angry about this, God. Just like Jonah was angry about you had mercy on those people he didn't want you to have mercy on. But you do bless me. You do love me. I trust that you are good and that you know what's best. And I suppose if I was in your shoes and I knew everything that you know, I would probably do the same thing. Thank God that he has to make all those tough decisions. You think it makes him any happier to make us angry, when I had to punish my kids and they would be angry with me, I didn't like that. It wasn't a joyful thing, but they grew up. And they started making better decisions. Not great, they're not perfect, but they started making better decisions. It hurts to make those choices. But that's how God is with us. He's willing to make those tough decisions. He's willing to suffer with us, right alongside with us, and have heartbreak along with us, so that we can grow into the people he wants us to be. So if you're here today and you're a Christian and this is how your faith looks, try to consider, what is it that am I trying to get out of my relationship with God? Am I trying to get more of him, or am I trying to get more of his things? But let's read on in the rest of our passage, because something interesting happens. He says, when he was in Jerusalem at Passover, during the feast, many believed in his name. They were observing his signs, which he was doing, but Jesus, on his part, was not entrusting himself to them, for he knew all men, and because he did not need anyone to testify concerning man, for he himself knew what was in man. Other passages say people tried to make him king, and he ran away from them. He slipped away from them. He knows what's in the heart of man. What is in mankind that Jesus knows about, that he wasn't trusting himself to them? Well, let's see. Jesus said this in Matthew 15. He says, the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and those that will not defile the man. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, slanders. These are the things which defile the man. What's he saying? This is what's in your heart. This is what's in the heart of mankind. I know what's in the heart of mankind. Jesus knows better than anybody. He was a man. He knows the kinds of temptations we have. He knows the thoughts that go through our heads. He knows what it's like to be human. He doesn't need anybody to tell him. This is our fundamental problem. As a species, we're broken and self-centered and selfish. Psalm 53 says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt and have committed abominable injustice. There is no one who does good. God has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if there is anyone who understands, who seeks after God. Every one of them has turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. That's what's in the heart of man. That's what Jesus knows. He's not going to trust himself to people because he knows there's no good ones. Isaiah 64, he says, for all of us, he didn't say all of you, he said all of us, including himself, have become like one who is unclean. All our righteous deeds are like a filthy garment, and all of us wither like a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, take us away. Even our good deeds, our own righteousness, the best things that we do, he says, are like filthy rags to God. Because we do them for selfish reasons, we do them for the wrong reasons, we do them, and it's just not right. It's broken. We're all broken. So when people wanted to take Jesus and make him king, He didn't, he was, I'm not here to be king this time. He's coming around again to be king later. But if he set up his kingdom then, guess what? He has to be the judge. How many people are going to be in his kingdom if he had to judge everybody then? How many? Well, what does this say? None. Every one of us deserves his judgment. So if he came to be king the first time around, his kingdom would be pretty empty. There'd be none of us in it. So instead, he came to suffer, to pay that penalty for our sins, so that the next time he comes around, some people can get in. That's what Isaiah said when he said, all of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. That's the point of the cross. All of us have strayed away from God. All of us. Jesus is the Lord of the feast. He wants to have that feast with us. He is the Lord of joy. In fact, heaven is described as a great feast. But he's also a judge. He has to judge sin. If he doesn't, it's not loving at all. You might say, well, how can a loving God judge me for my sin? Which is great for you, but what about the people who you've sinned against? If someone breaks into your house and robs you and beats you up, and then they get arrested and the judge says, well, he seems like he didn't mean it, so I forgive him. Where's your justice? There is none, right? It has to be judged. And so he judged. And he took that punishment upon himself. And this is one of the most amazing passages in the Bible. It's in Colossians 2:13. He says, when you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, we were dead because of our sin. We were guilty. He made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all of our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us. And he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. We deserve his judgment. We want the feast, but we deserve the judgment. But here comes Jesus and says, you know what? You're all guilty, but I'm going to take that penalty for myself. He nails it to the cross so that we can have that feast with him. So he can be the Lord of the feast for us, so we can have that joy of union with God. He said he didn't just make us alive and send us on our way. He said that he made us alive together with him, forgiving us of our transgressions. He paid that penalty. Now, if you're here today and you haven't put your faith in Christ, I'm urging you. What that means is to say to God, I don't want to have a transaction because I don't have the money. A transaction for me to get into heaven would require my life, and I wouldn't get in because I don't have the money. The only way I can get into heaven is by accepting Christ's forgiveness on the cross. That's the only way to get in. God, I put my faith that what he did was enough to get me into heaven. That's what it means to be a Christian. And I urge you to do that. Urge you to make that decision because we all want that feast. We all want that union with our Creator. But what we deserve is his judgment. And he knows it, but he loves us enough to nail it to the cross with his Son. And so that's what's in man, and that is the cleansing of the temple. Let's stop there. So if this is your first time here, that's awesome. Feel free to pick up a free book that's over there at the welcome table. If you want to, we're going to have some time for questions and answers. If you want to ask a question, great, we'll bring you a microphone. If not, feel free to, if you want to ask a question, but not in front of everybody, feel free to fill out one of these cards and give us some feedback there if you have any suggestions. If this is your church, the bag will come around. You have an opportunity to give to the church financially to help us pay the bills. But if this is not your church, we're not asking for your money. We don't want your money. Feel free to pass that bag on by. So the kids are in Oasis, being well-supervised, I'm sure. So make sure you pick them up by 11:45, because after that, the supervision level drops dramatically, and things get ugly. So if you have questions or comments, raise your hand, we'll bring you a microphone. Right up here.
I've heard a couple of...
Hello?
Come on.
Is it on?
Okay. It's on now.
Okay. I've heard a couple of different explanations of the 3 days and three nights.
Mm-hmm.
If the Sabbath starts on Friday, you got Friday night and Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
But he said 3 days and three nights. I've heard a couple of explanations. Do you have an opinion?
Well, way to give me a softball there. Actually, yeah, the Hebrew day night, the way they would explain that is any part of a day is the day. So just this morning is today. And so it counts as 3 days and three nights. And when you're talking about three days, three nights, you're talking about three periods of time, 3 days. And any part of that day, so part of the Saturday, Friday counts as one, Saturday counts as two, and the part of the Sunday counts as three, so that's the 3 days. Does that help? Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. The day and night, we break it up in our language as day and night, but in their language, it's one unit, and any part of that unit is part of the whole, if that helps explain it. Yeah, over here.
Thanks, Adam. Another softball.
Oh, good.
So I know this wasn't the main point of your teaching, which was great, by the way, about transactional, you know, relationship there. But Jesus referred to himself as the temple. He says, "I am the temple," and we know the connotations there. You explained,
mm-hmm.
you know, that he was referring to his body and his crucifixion. 3 days, he'll be raised. But they didn't immediately understand that
mm-hmm.
at all. Well, not even immediately. They didn't understand it at all. They thought he was talking about the physical structure.
Right.
And we see further down in the passage that the disciples realized that. They recognized it later on when he was raised.
Right.
So can you speak to a little bit more about why Jesus didn't just come out and say, "I'm going to be crucified, and in 3 days I'm going to be raised"? Why was it so cryptic for anybody that might not understand that? I don't know that we always fully understand why he didn't just come out and say it plainly.
Well, he did later to his disciples. He did explain them, and they still didn't get it. These are people who had spent 3 years with him, and he was on his way to Jerusalem for the final time. He says, "They're going to crucify me, and I'm going to die, and in 3 days later, I'm going to come back to life." And they still didn't get it. So it's not shocking, because it's people just stay dead. That's normally how it works. And so I don't know that him saying, "You're going to crucify me, and I'm going to come back to life," would have helped. Maybe they would have said, "Well, let's not crucify him." Or maybe they would have said, "All right, let's do it right now. Let's see." But it wasn't his time yet. So that's a good question. It just wasn't his time, and I don't think the point of that was he wanted it was going to happen. He wanted people to know afterwards that it was true. And so if you start explaining that kind of stuff to people, things might get contrived in such a way that that's just not according to his plan. And so he did it that way specifically so afterwards, I think, his disciples and everybody else would understand that this is what he meant and this is what was going on and this is what happened. There's no doubt that he came back to life. That's one of the most well-documented things in history is that Jesus Christ was dead and that he came back to life. Now, what do you want to do with that is up to you, but the Romans, if he was dead, they would have paraded his body around and said, "Nope, he's still dead." And that would have been the end of Christianity, but that's not what happened because he wasn't there. So I think that's why. He just didn't want it to happen then, and he didn't want it to happen in any other way other than his planned way. And the whole point of him was to tell them was so they would recognize after it happened rather than before it happened. I'll answer your question. Any other easy questions? Over here.
Oh, no question.
Okay.
Just a comment. I remember years ago going to a home church, and one of the guys there said that he was going to stop coming to home church because they wasn't getting anything out of it.
Mm.
And I kind of pondered that. What was I getting out of it? And so fortunately, the personal relationships that you build in a home church allowed me to find somebody that was, I could ask that question.
Yeah.
What are we supposed to get out of coming to home church? And he turned around and asked me a question. He says, "What do you put into it?" And it kind of dumbfounded me. Well, I'm supposed to get something out of this. I'm coming here to get something out.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned it around on me and said, "What are you putting into it?" And so I figured out that, I'm doing some things. I'm helping other people just by interacting with them, talking to them. I'll have opportunities to help someone with things that I could do to help them out. And I realized that my participation was edifying to myself and in some way other people too. And so looking at the guys in the temple, they were getting stuff out of being at the temple. And it was pretty self-serving. And so that wasn't a good reason to go to Central Teaching or home church, is to get money out of it. But the personal interaction that you get from helping other people is so rewarding. It was like, wow. And I wish I'd had that insight to talk to this guy about that when he was telling me he was not coming back because he wasn't getting anything out of it anymore. So,
thanks for sharing that. That's a great point. It's a transaction. Granted, when we're new and we want to learn, you get a lot out of meetings like this where you're being instructed, you're getting into God's Word, and you can learn about it yourself, and you can take it home, and you can, which is what I hope everybody's doing, is making sure that I'm not lying to you and reading it for yourself and getting enriched by it. But eventually you get to the point where, okay, I've learned. I mean, there's no secret levels to Christianity, right? We don't have anything else to teach. It's in the Bible. Read it. And once you've got it, you're going to do something with it or you're not. And at that point, when you come to the meetings, it's less about feed me. It's more about how can I feed others? How can I help others? And it's not so much a transaction as it is, I love God, and what I've learned is changing my life, and I want to enrich other people for it, just because I love Him, and He loves them too. And so that's when you really start, it becomes less of a transaction, but God still blesses you, you still get a lot out of it, but it's not because you're not doing it for that, you're doing it for Him, for His glory. So you might have some dry spells where you're not getting that payback, but you're bound to be blessed by it because God wants you to do that, and you want to honor Him. You can honor Him whether or not you get blessed or not. So that's a great point. Thanks for bringing that up. Any other questions or comments? Right here.
I've often thought about how easy it is to just, you know, accept Christ and just move on with your life. That sort of thing. You don't often think about how to have a true relationship with Christ. It's just pretty easy to just move on. And the part about you said about the heart being like your words come out of it, I think. I was pretty surprised by that. I do remember a part in the Bible that talks about, like, you know, the first time.
That's okay.
The idea of transactional faith is, like, something I've really considered. It's like, people don't often think about that. And when Jesus says, like, He's going to build the temple back up in like 3 days instead of this, the temple originally was built in like 46 years. So something I've always noticed in the Bible is that
it's okay.
I'm sorry, I don't often do this sort of thing.
It's okay, I understand. It's not easy to talk in front of people. The Bible is very often doesn't tell you what you expect it to say.
Yeah, it's kind of like, when I've read the Bible, it's like Jesus is speaking all this, like, I guess you could say they're riddles, almost.
Parables, yeah.
Like the part about the temple, you know. He was actually talking about, like, his body, how it felt like he's resurrecting, like, 3 days instead of just, he wasn't talking about the temple itself.
Right.
I always thought it was kind of funny that how he goes all out on those people in the temple that were all those businessmen. He causes all that kind of chaos. But he has a good point. People there are people out there who just want to use the church to just to make money and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They don't care about what they don't just they don't do it so they can have people get relationships with God. Mm-hmm. They do it so they can make some extra money. So Jesus was, I think Jesus was pretty justified in what he did.
Yeah,
getting them out of his father's house.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
I think my dad wants to say something.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, I just think that's a good point. How there's a righteous anger there, mm-hmm. right? And it always struck me with the temple and well, God's mad here, right? And I'm not used to seeing a God who's mad, but it talks about that's certainly a righteous anger that he's allowed to do that, and it's a good thing, you know. Yeah. So it demonstrated to me the passion that God has for his house and how we need to show him respect that.
Yeah, I mean, take a look at why he's angry. It's not just that they were making money, but it's that they were ruining the relationships there between him and his people. That Passover was there so that they could have a real relationship with him and discover and really contemplate, my sin has a real effect on the world around me and a real effect on God, and it deserves judgment. And that's what these animal sacrifices are all about. And they were just turning it into a transaction, so now I can do whatever I want. And that's what really made him angry. So what made him happy was the relationships with each other that we were celebrating, that wedding before. What made him angry is that people were ruining their relationship with him. They were warping it in such a way that they weren't getting a relationship with him. And that's what got under his skin. And that is a righteous anger. God wants to have these deep relationships with us. And every other religion in the world says, well, you don't get to heaven by anything except your own effort. Your deeds have to outnumber your bad deeds, whatever that means. Like, there's a score involved. And Christianity is the only one that says, there's no way you can get to heaven. God's standard is way too high. It's perfection. So the only way to get to heaven is to be forgiven, and that's through Christ. That is essential to Christianity, and it's unique in all religions of the world. And I think that's one of the reasons that draws so many people to it, because eventually we're going to admit, I'm not perfect. And I can get to God, though, through Christ. And he'll take anybody. As long as we say, his death paid for my sins, I want that to apply to me, he'll take anybody. That's fantastic. All right, well, let's take a moment. We'll pray together. If you'd like to pray out loud, we'll bring you the microphone and you can pray, too.